Okay, dear students, well, we're going to continue our coverage of fundamental analysis of stock investments with Chapter 17, Projecting Cash Flow and Earnings. Well, not really. It's actually financial statements and ratio analysis, but that's what the book calls it. I call it financial statements and ratio analysis. We will look at the ratios, but we only need to compute a few because once you've done a couple of them, three or four, the rest are pretty darn easy. We've already done a little bit of forecasting, so we're going to skip that. So let's get started on slide number 2 with financial statements. The more you know about accounting, the more you're going to be able to understand these financial statements and they'll make sense to you. But don't worry, you don't have to be an accountant to understand the financial statements. In fact, we don't do any accounting in here. We let the accountants create the financial statements. So don't worry, you accounting students, no trial balances, no journal entries. Don't start screaming and jumping up and down, weeping and gnashing of teeth and beating of breath. We just read the darn things. And there are three that we need to familiarize ourselves with. The balance sheet, the income statement, and the cash flow statement, also called the statement of cash flows. The balance sheet shows us the firm's assets and liabilities and shareholders' equity at a given point in time, whereas the financial statement is a summary of the operating results of a firm covering a specified period of time, quarterly or yearly results. Now, what's the cash flow statement? Well, this is where the accountants cringe when we in financial planning and money management call our income statement a cash flow statement because it's an income statement, really, but we just use the term cash flow because it makes sense. Where's our money going? But cash flow statement in accounting is something very different. It shows us what's happening under the surface of the income statement. Where is the cash flowing from and to? Whereas the income statement is basically showing us revenue and then expenses and what we have earned after those, what's left over. But there are many moving parts in a corporation that don't get covered in the income statement, and that's the cash flow statement. So let's quickly take a look at the balance sheet. Now, on the website and in Canvas, there are two companies we've taken a look at, Sprouts and Ford. Ford, the numbers are a whole lot bigger, right? Because it's a large cap company, whereas Sprouts, you know who they are, is a small cap company. So we'll take a look at Sprouts because the numbers are not as large. And I have them already queued up here. So let's see if I can make this a little bit bigger so that it's easier to read. And it goes back 4 years. And I got most of these from Yahoo and MarketWatch, although normally you want to go straight to the source and get them right from the company. But I just show it because these are easier. They're not as sophisticated, and you accountants can figure out the more tougher ones. So the balance sheet shows us our assets. Now, the accountants break things into two. We break time horizons into three or more, short-term, intermediate-term, and long-term. No. Accountants say anything that's used within a year is current. That's their term for short-term assets. Anything that is a year, greater than a year, is long-term. So we break things into current assets like cash, accounts receivable, inventories. And what do these things mean? Well, we'll go through them quickly as we walk through our ratios. But many of them you don't have to worry about. And certainly the more, as we say, the more accounting experience you have, the more it's going to make sense. So this is what the corporation owns, the assets that are going to be utilized within a year and then longer term assets. And they break the same things into liabilities. Liabilities are debts that are due within a year. And anything above a year is considered long term. So you take the total assets minus the total liabilities, and what do you have left over? Common stock, stockholders' equity. In other words, what the company owns of itself. Now, notice that this, a lot of this stuff doesn't apply for Sprouts, mostly because it's a smaller company. And you'll notice, wait a minute, retained earnings, they're included in the common stock number here. So that's why you add these two up. You say, wait a minute, how can you add 200,000 and 881,000 and wind up with 881,000? It's just that it's not added into that amount. Okay, so that was the balance sheet. Assets minus liabilities equals equity. And we'll use some of the items off of the balance sheet later on. Now let's go back and take a look at the income statement. So the income statement shows us the difference between a company's revenues, sales, money coming in the door, and expenses, payroll, rent, and the like, plus the dividends that are paid. Any amounts that are earned and are not paid out in the form of dividends are considered retained earnings and are usually used to finance the future growth of the company. So here is the formula. Net income equals revenue minus expenses. As we'll see on the next slide, income and expenses are not always received or paid for in cash. But before we do that, let's go take a look at the income statement. And this should look fairly familiar to you who have taken Business 121 Financial Planning and Money Management. We certainly don't call it revenue. We call it our income, our job. But then, in the case of a company, we take in the top line number. That's the annual sales, net sales, total revenue. But then it costs us something to make that cost of revenue. In the case of Sprouts, they don't grow the food. They don't make the food. They sell it. So they had to pay for that food. That's the cost of revenue. That gives us our gross profit. Then we also have sales, general and administrative, or sales, administrative and operating expenses. Yeah, you're supposed to, everyone knows that, right? Research and development. Well, Sprouts doesn't really have any research and development. And that gives us operating expenses. So here's the cost of revenue, gives us the gross product. We take gross profit. And then we subtract the operating expenses and we get operating income. Well, that's not the end of it. No, because there are other expenses, other incomes. There's income before interest and taxes, and then we have to pay the interest. And then there's the income before tax, and then we got to pay the tax. And now finally we get to net income. And this is the number that we report to the IRS and say, okay, IRS, this is how much money we made. We have to pay taxes on it. And that's called the bottom line, net income, net profit. So maybe some of these numbers are making more sense when you listened to that earnings call. Top line growth, bottom line growth, yeah, speak of the language. Now, back to the presentation. We said some income and expenses are not always received or paid for in cash, and that is why there is the cash flow statement, or statement of cash flows. And as we said, the accountants cringe when we call our cash flow statement in Business 121 Financial Planning and Money Management. We call it a cash flow statement, and they say, no, that's an income statement. And we say, give us a break, will you? We're not accountants. So there are many ways cash can flow into a corporation, out of a corporation, without being on the income statement. Income and expense items not realized in cash flow form, that's typically depreciation. You don't write a check to depreciation, but it allows you to reduce your income and thereby reduce your taxes. The operating cash flow, that's generated by the firm's normal business operations. And then there are investment cash flows and financing cash flows, which may or may not affect your checkbook. So the earnings that we report to the IRS are not necessarily what happened to our checkbook. The statement of cash flows, the cash flow says yes. The cash flow statement says yes. This is what happened to our checkbook. This is what happened to our cash. And as we said before, some companies were reporting record earnings and the checkbook balance was going down. How could that be? Well, because they were reporting earnings for which they did not receive the money. And in the case of Lucent Technologies, they were selling tons of telephone equipment in the late 90s, but not getting the cash. The companies were saying, no, we'll pay you over the next 20, 30 years, and then they promptly went broke. So that's why the cash flow statement is something we want to take a look at to see if the earnings we're getting are being translated into cash flow. And we'll discuss cash flow in a bit. So where do we get these? Well, I was using the ones off of Yahoo and MarketWatch. And why? Because they're just easier. But reality, folks, we need to go to EDGAR, the annual report, the 10K, and the quarterly report, the 10Q. Why? Because that's the source. The company itself needs to report these every quarter and every year. And now, if it's not right, and it be shown that they were playing fast and loose with the rules, the head, the muckety mucks, the CEO and the CFO, they can go to jail. In the late 90s, the technology became much more potent with the telecommunications and the internet. And so the SEC said, okay, we're going to create a regulation called FD, Fair Disclosure. And we're going to require companies now to give everyone the public information at the exact same time. See, it used to be that you could go to a presentation if you were an analyst or somebody on Wall Street, and you would learn things before the general public learned them. Well, no more. Now, and of course, it was very difficult to do it without the internet. Now it's very easy. They call an earnings call. They say, okay, you know, this day at 9:30 in the morning or 4:30 in the afternoon, we're going to have an earnings call. And so everybody can log on at the same time when the materials go out to the public. And that's what you did in Chapter 5. Hopefully you didn't necessarily go to the live earnings call. You might have listened to it afterwards or read about it afterwards. But this is what is required now of companies. They cannot give out this information to somebody special beforehand. And of course, there are countless other sources. And I've heard many investors opine that nowadays there's simply too much information. That's what I feel. You know, just there's just so much information coming at you. I mean, just Value Line alone, right? And but then there are just dozens of other sources. And I love this guy, Nick Murray. You probably will never read any books by him, but he had a great saying. Wisdom sold separately. Exactly. If you're going to want help to try to make sense of all this stuff, it's going to cost you, right? Which is why you're taking this class and you're going to be the investment guru, the investment analyst, the financial guru for your friends and family and coworkers. And that's a very important and weighty responsibility. Slide number 7, financial ratios. Well, they're actually very simple, folks. It's just a relation between two financial quantities expressed as a quotient. You take one and you divide it by the other. And the ratio analysis is the study of the relationships between financial statement of accounts. If you recall, we said that there is no one ratio that can accurately sum up the overall general state of a company. Each ratio must be considered in the context of all the information gathered. Plus, you must also consider any ratio in the context of the industry the company exists within. You can't just look at Ford or Sprouts. You have to look at their competitors. Yes. Oh, we didn't look at the... Oh, I forgot to look at the cash flow statement. I am so sorry. Let's backtrack. My apologies. Here's the cash flow statement. And what... Notice that the cash flow statement... Oh, I'm so sorry. I am old. Notice the cash flow statement starts with the net income. It starts where the income statement ended. Okay, Sprouts, you said you earned over... this is, you have to multiply by 1,000 because this is all the numbers are expecting 1,000. You earned almost $500 million last year. How much cash really came in the door? Well, notice right away, we add back in a depreciation. We add that back into our cash. Why? Because we didn't write a check for depreciation. We were able to tell the IRS, yes, we reduced our income by $225 million, but we didn't have to write a check for $225 million. That was just an accounting entry, which allowed us to reduce our taxes, but that cash came in the door. And then there are other changes and of the like of certain cash items. We made, or not we, but Sprouts made a capital expenditure of $122 million, which you don't get to expense. You have to depreciate that. You don't. What does that mean? That means you can't write off the whole $122 million that year. You have to spread it out. That's what depreciation means, and you accounting students already know this. And then we had some borrowing into the mix. So it turns out that in the year 2000, our checkbook went up $82.5 million. So that's the statement of cash flows. And it's a good sign because it means the cash flow is positive. We have a cash flow positive company. So they're not recording record earnings, but the checkbook is going down. They are actually bringing cash in the door. My apologies. Okay, so we're going to do some financial ratio analysis, dear students. And we're going to find that we've already gone over some of these ratios. In fact, we've gone over a lot of them. And we're going to go over them again very quickly. But then in our next presentation, we'll tackle some that we haven't seen yet. So let's continue on slide number 8 with the common stock ratios. And as we said, most of these we've already discussed. Price to earnings, dividends per share, dividend yield, dividend payout ratio, book value per share, price to book, price to cash flow, price to sales. The one we haven't looked at is the PEG ratio, which is you don't see, some people use it. It's not that important. It's actually pretty straightforward. So all these common stock ratios typically are very easy to find. You don't even have to calculate them. You just go on the Infernal Net and they tell you them. But they use data from the balance sheet or the income statement, or both. So we're going to have to bounce back and forth between the balance sheet and the income statement to find much of the data that we use to make our calculations. But we've already gone over these common stock ratios, except for the PEG ratio. We've already done all of them, so you already know how to do these. So the PE ratio, the price to earnings ratio, the most popular stock market statistic. And to review, historically, PE ratios were in the 5 to 12 range for mature companies, 14 to 20 range for growing companies. Greater than 20 was unusual. Today, it is commonplace. The PE ratio also tells you how long it will take in years, assuming no changes in earnings, for the company to earn back its price. A PE of 3 will take 3 years. A PE of 20 will take 20 years. And some people say, well, why is that important? It's not really that important, but it's something to think about. The lower the PE, the typically less volatile and risky the stock. The higher the PE, obviously, the more risky. But there might be a very good reason why the PE is low, meaning the stock's future doesn't look that great. And there might be a very good reason why the PE is high, because the future does look sanguine, does look optimistic for that company. But when you see companies like Shopify or Spotify, whichever one, Shopify, the PE's in the hundreds, and then you look at Tesla with a PE over 1,000. Yeah, dear students, to me it just means we're in a bubble. I don't know when it's going to end. I have no idea, but I do know there's going to be dead bodies all over the place, and the parachutes had better be very, very large. Slide number 10. So here are some PE ratios from companies that really don't have much in common. ExxonMobil, NA, what does that mean? Well, it means that they're losing money, so the PE ratio is not available or not applicable. It's actually negative, right? Because if you have a price over a negative earnings, you're going to wind up with a negative price to earnings ratio. But Facebook is almost 30. Amgen, what are they? That's a biotech company at 20. U.S. Bank, 18. Well, banks usually don't have very high PEs. We like banks to be boring. General Mills, they make Cheerios, 15. That's, you know, not that high. By today's standards, it's actually pretty darn low. And then Pfizer, a drug manufacturer, about 20, 21 or so, which is, again, usually pretty high, but these days that's actually fairly low. Well, what are we missing? We need to look at companies that are like these companies. Look at the energy companies. All of them are losing money. Yeah, thank you very much, Mr. COVID virus. The energy companies have just been hit hard by the downturn of the global economy, but they're also hearing people say, well, we don't need oil anymore. Well, that's a ridiculous statement. Oil is too important a commodity to think that we're not going to need it. Hopefully we'll have a whole lot of electric cars in the future so that we won't be pumping out carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. What product do you buy and bring home to burn? But still, no, oil is very important. So now might be a good time to look towards the future for your energy stocks. Well, let's take a look at Facebook and Twitter. What's going on? Well, Facebook's actually making money and paying, making money sporting a kind of high a PE, and Twitter's losing money, so the PE is not ethical. But Google is actually a little bit higher than Facebook. So investors are actually a little bit more excited about Google's prospects vis-a-vis Facebook. But they're darn right euphoric when it comes to Amazon and Netflix, aren't they? Oh, yeah, 73.5, 84. Those are very high PEs. Now, I'm not trying to disparage the companies, certainly, and I'm not trying to say that the stocks are bad buys. Remember our example where Google had a PE of around 60-something, 67? GM's PE was about 6. GM went bankrupt. Google went on to become a very profitable investment for people. So we need to do more research. When we see something like this, it's like a little red flag. Look at me, something's weird here. Something's out of the ordinary. Does Amazon deserve this PE? Does Netflix deserve this PE? We got more research to do. Same thing happens in the biotech world. Amgen, 20, but biotech, 11. That's not usual for a biotech company. We need to do some research there. But look at AbbVie and then Illumina, 38, 93. Obviously, investors are not too excited about Biogen's future, and they are very excited about AbbVie and Illumina. And then we take a look at the banks. Banks should be boring, dear students, but they were for many decades, and then came the deregulation of the 1990s, and then the global financial crash of the 2000s, and they started looking boring again. Now people are bidding up the prices relative to the earnings of the banks. So that scares me when I see a bank of a 20 PE or 18 or even 17, although JP Morgan, look, these banks are not going anywhere, too big to fail. But then when we see Wells Fargo, almost 100, what's going on there? Well, remember, it's a ratio. The price in the numerator could get large, which makes the quotient larger, or the earnings in the denominator could get smaller, which would raise the value of the quotient. So it might just be that Wells Fargo is having an off year and their earnings are down, pushing up the PE. And people are looking past that to say, oh, you know, don't worry, it'll get back down again when their earnings bounce back after COVID. I don't know. I haven't done the research, but again, it's a red flag. It's something we need to research to determine exactly why. And maybe we can't figure out why. Maybe it's just, well, who knows. But typically, when that happens, what did Mr. Peter Lynch call it? The Wile E. Coyote stock. The stock that, like the Wile E. Coyote, runs out off the cliff and then is standing in midair. And it's not until he realizes that he's in the midair, that nothing below him, that he finally starts falling. And the same thing happens over here in food companies. You know, General Mills, Kellogg's, Hormel. Well, Hormel's high, 29. Hormel makes Spam. If I were Hormel, I would have an email advertising campaign and say, this is Spam. Kraft Heinz, 135? Again, what's going on here? It's a red flag. It's a little marker that says we need to do more research. It might just be that it's an anomaly, or it might be something far more serious. Not too exciting over here in the pharmaceutical world, is there? Pfizer's a little over 21. You know, not too high by today's standards. And then these two, Eli Lilly and Merck, a little higher, but then Bristol-Myers, NA, what does that mean? They're losing money, which again is like a little marker that might mean, hey, what's going on with Bristol-Myers? Let's see if they're out of favor with investors and what is their 3 to 5 year using the value line or whatever system you're interested in. What's their prognosis for the next 3 to 5 years? Cool. So PE ratios are the most widely used statistic, and they're all over the map. In fact, for me these days, I got to tell you, the large cap companies, I just think, because they're my favorite, right? Especially ones that pay dividend. They're really outrageously priced. When you look at the PE, when you look at other things too. Whereas lately I've been looking at mid-cap and small-cap companies and realizing that, hey, these guys have much better PE ratios. That's not the only thing we have to look at, right? That's just the beginning to do research. But at least the parachutes are much larger with the small-cap and mid-cap companies than they are with the large-cap companies, which is usually not the case. It's usually the other way around. Slide number 11. How can we account for the wide PE disparity between different industries and different companies within industries? Well, again, it is the expectation of future earnings and potentially future dividend growth by investors. It's all about what the company is going to produce in the future in terms of earnings and dividends. And this is from the Random Walk Down Wall Street. It's a quote by Jack Dreyfus, who was the founder of the Dreyfus Funds, which are now owned by Bank of New York, which, by the way, is the world's oldest bank. Take a nice little company, not the world's, I'm sorry, what did I say? The world's, it's the United States' oldest bank, the Bank of New York. You don't hear too much about it, they're the nation's oldest bank. Take a nice little company that has been making shoelaces for 40 years and sells at a respectable 6x earnings ratio. Change the name from Shoelaces Incorporated to Electronics and Silicon Firth Burners. In today's market, This was in the 1960s. The words electronics and silicon are worth 15 times earnings. However, the real play comes from the word firth burner, which no one understands. A word that no one understands entitles you to double your entire score. Therefore, we have 6 times earnings for the shoelace business and 15 earnings for the electronics and silicon for a total of 21 times earnings. Multiply this by 2 for firth burners, and we now have a score of 42 times earnings for the new company. He's being tongue-in-cheek. He's being sarcastic. But it's true. It's true. You replace firth burners with cryptocurrencies or 3D printing. Replace electronics and silicon with social networking, China, or marijuana, or NFTs, or TFNs, or whatever the hell they are. Non-fungible assets, non-fungible NFAs, whatever. Then you get to skyrocket your PE ratio. And investors they buy into it. Yeah. Indeed. The next greatest thing. No thanks. Slide number 12. The price to earnings to growth ratio, called the PEG ratio. Well, this is interesting. You know, this is something to think about again, just another piece of information. It compares the PE ratio to the rate of growth. The idea being that the rate of growth should be relatively close to the PE ratio. So you take the PE ratio and you divide it by the 3 to 5 year rate of growth in the earnings. So a PE ratio of 1 means that the two are the same. If you have a PE ratio of 20 and a 5 year growth rate of 20%, 20 divided by 20 would be 1. If the PE ratio was higher than 1, that means if the PEG ratio were higher than 1, the PE ratio is higher than the growth rate, and anything below is the opposite. So a PE ratio of 1 was considered desirable because the PE was equal to the growth rate. Anything above 1 was considered high, and no. Now greater than 1 is common. In fact, it's just what you'll see, a PEG ratio of 3 or 5 or 7 or 100. So that's something to think about. Well, let's take a... Let's think about the PEG ratio for, say, Tesla. Tesla has a PE of over 1,000, but folks, their sales have been growing at 50%. I'm not sure about their earnings, but still, let's say their earnings were growing at 50%. So that would be 1,000 over 50. So that would be a PEG ratio of 20. And we said 1 was desirable. That's the kind of investing that's going on right now. And I'm not trying to disparage Tesla. I hope they succeed. I certainly hope they succeed. I love them. But I wouldn't touch their stock with a 24-foot pole. Slide 13, dividends per share. This is review. This is a measure of how much dividends each share of stock will receive. You take the annual dividends paid to shareholders, number of shares outstanding. As we discussed, dividends were once taboo, but now dividends can be discussed in polite company again. I love dividends. Dividends don't lie. The dividend yield takes the dividends per share and then divides them by market price per share. So it's a percentage of the stock price. This allows an investor to compare a company to other forms of investments that pay dividends, such as savings accounts or bonds. Traditionally, 4 to 6% was considered good, but now the S&P 500 is yielding it's down to 1.6 or 1.5%, and Treasury bonds are now above 1%, or like 1.6 or so. They were under 1 just about a few months ago, and now, but of course, many savings accounts are still yielding far less than 1%. But you're starting to see some savings accounts paying over 1%. Some stocks are paying much more, and you've seen a few, right? While many growth stocks don't pay any dividends, but that's what you expect. You don't expect a company that's growing to be paying dividends. Why? Because they need the retained earnings to grow the business. And then the dividend payout ratio, again, this is review. This is a measure of how much a company's earnings are being paid out to shareholders in the form of dividends. So it's very simple. You take the dividends per share and divide it by the earnings per share. So if a company is very mature, they don't need those dividends, those retained earnings. They don't need the retained earnings to grow the company. So utilities and food companies and the like can pay out a healthy portion of their earnings in the form of dividends. Whereas growing companies need those retained earnings to support the growth of the business. So we have to look at the payout ratio. Again, as with all ratios, we need to look at the competitors to make sure that they're in line with what the competitors are doing. And if they're not, we need to know why. It just creates more questions for us, more research for us to do, so that we get the full picture of the potential investment. The book value per share, review. We take the common stockholders' equity, how much the stockholders own, and divide it by the number of shares. The book value per share tells an investor how much assets are behind each share of stock on the books. That's what the accountants say they're worth. They might not be worth that when they actually go to try to sell the assets. In other words, if all the assets of a company were liquidated, how much would each shareholder receive? It is common for the actual market price of a share to be far above the book value per share, since the company is certainly worth more intact than if it were dissolved. It used to be 1 or 1.8, 2 or so when you took the book value above the market value. I'm sorry, the market value above the book value, but now 6 or so is, or more is typical when you compare the book value to the market value. I'm sorry, the market value to the book value. My apologies. The market value is almost always large. And we've already discussed this, right? What happens if the book value becomes greater or the market value falls below the book value? Right. Assuming those assets are worth what the accountants say they're worth, the company becomes a target to be liquidated because the shareholders can, private equity artists, private takeover artists can swoop in, liquidate the company, pay off all the assets, and walk away with money in their pockets. Price to book value per share. This is what I was just talking about. My apologies. I should have waited until the next slide. You take the market price per share and divide it by the book value per share. Given that the book value per share is often less than the market price, the price to book value per share tells an investor how far above the book value the market is. If the price to book value, right, market price divided by book value is equal to 1, they're the same. But as we said, 3 or 4 or 6 or 7 or 10 is not uncommon. Why? Because it just makes sense. The company is in business to make money. They are worth above and beyond what the assets are on the books because they're in business. Think of a pizza shop or a shoe shop. The assets really aren't that much what they have on the books. It's the fact that they're generating income. It makes sense. Now, price to cash flow. We discussed this in the previous chapter. We take the price and we divide it by the cash flow per share as opposed to the earnings per share. And as we said, cash flow often differs from earnings per share for many reasons on the statement of cash flows. But the most common reason is the depreciation. We look at good quality versus poor quality earnings. As we talked about during the internet mania, many companies were reporting record earnings. At the same time, their cash flow was negative. So how could that be? Well, as we said, the one instance of Lucent Technologies, where they were raking in the sales, but the earnings were not coming in the form of cash. They were just simply IOUs that the company was going to be paid back over the next 20 years. But all the companies that bought their equipment went out of, well, not all of them, but most of them went out of business. Yeah, not good. And then lastly, price to sales. As we used in the last chapter, we take the price and divide it by the sales. And to review, During the internet mania, many analysts use price to sales instead of price to earnings, since most all the new companies never generated earnings. So if you're looking at earnings and they ain't none, and there ain't no cash flow, well, there's maybe a negative cash flow, then sure, let's look at the sales. Oh my goodness, the sales are going up, but we're losing more money every year. So all these, except for the PEG ratio, which is pretty straightforward, and it's usually reported in places like Yahoo and the like, are all ratios that we've already done. We've already gone through these. In our next presentation, we will do actually some new ratios, and some of which you'll find online easily, and others, no, you got to do yourself. So what would be useful is if you were to print out the income statement and the balance sheet so you had them in your hot little hands, or you could just stop the presentation and run, go look at the balance sheet or the income statement to verify that you found where they are. Because this is what we're going to ask you to do. We're going to ask you to take a look at the balance sheet, the income statement for a couple of companies, and see if you can figure out these ratios. Now, the ones that we've just done, the common stock ratios, the market ratios, they're often reported to you. So fine, do a few of those, but don't do all of them. You know, we want you to do some calculations. We want you to hunt and peck and find those things that we'll discuss in our next presentation. So we'll see you in our second presentation for financial ratio analysis when we go through the financial ratios that we haven't covered yet. See you in our next presentation, dear students. We are always, always, always grateful, proud, honored that you are with us, and you are awesome. Don't give up. Never give up.